From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. It's Women's History Month, and coming up, we'll be talking about some notable women from Illinois, past and present, some you've likely heard of, others perhaps not. Plus, we'll be sharing some of our listener suggestions for women who ought to be more well-known. That's later this hour. But first, it's our weekly Reporters Roundtable, and this time we're taking a look at some of the big stories affecting both Iowa and Illinois. We've been excited to recently welcome listeners from WVIK, the Quad Cities NPR station. For a quick refresher on Quad Cities geography, it's actually five cities. In Illinois, that's Moline, East Moline, and Rock Island. Across the river in Iowa, it's Bettendorf and Davenport. So for some of our listeners on what I like to think of as Illinois' West Coast, policies in Iowa affect life in Illinois and vice versa. To take a closer look at some of the stories affecting the region, we're joined by Michelle O'Neill, news editor at partner NPR station WVIK. Sarah Hayden is a news reporter covering politics and government for the cities of Moline and Rock Island at the Dispatch Argus and Quad City Times in Davenport, Iowa. And we're also joined by Stephen Gruber-Miller, who covers the Iowa State House and politics for the Des Moines Register. Thank you all so much for being with us today. And Michelle, I'm going to start with you. One of the big stories, Iowa has lifted its mask mandate. Illinois and 32 other states still require them in public. Michelle, you're in the Quad Cities on the border between Illinois and Iowa. What have you been hearing about how this is going down, particularly from businesses on both sides of
the river? Really, the businesses have all the way along from the beginning of the pandemic and lockdowns, the chamber has requested from the state of Illinois that the restrictions would be lifted all at the same time for the Quad Cities area. And that has not happened. The governor has been very firm about keeping those restrictions in place. And in the Iowa Quad Cities, we can go eat in restaurants there a lot more freely than in the Illinois Quad Cities. So the jobs that have been lost or at least put on pause are worse in the Quad Cities county of Rock Island County, and not quite as bad in Scott County. And on Facebook, I watch and read comments about all these things. I'm a member of a group called COVID Safe Quad Cities, and they're sharing information about where it's safe to go, where people are following mask mandates, whether or not they're in Iowa or Illinois. So individuals are really taking it upon themselves to support businesses that they feel are safe. And on the other hand, we have other Facebook groups which say, oh, they're not making me wear a mask, so I'll go there. So it's been kind of interesting.
Yeah, interesting. People playing both sides of that. You know, I think one of the previous times we've talked to you on the show last year, it was earlier in the pandemic, you mentioned that I think it was a river trail, some sort of walking area. Iowa was sort of bustling with people. The Illinois side was a little more of a ghost town. Are you still seeing that effect in the two areas?
No, I think people have gotten really a little stir crazy over the winter. And I'm seeing more people on the Illinois side of the river using trails and biking. And also, of course, in Iowa. So it's not so much anymore.
So, Stephen, I want to bring you into the conversation. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds made this decision. Can you talk a little bit about how she went about it and, you know, whether she is supported in this by legislators, voters, public health officials in the state?
Right. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on the show. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds has said pretty consistently that she wants to sort of dial up restrictions when things get serious and dial them back down when she feels like the metrics and data call for that. She's been focused especially on hospitalization numbers, which have really come down in Iowa from last fall when they were pretty, like, quite severely high. And so I think that the fall in those hospitalization numbers, led her to sort of make this decision. She continues to say that people should, you know, take the appropriate precautions, but she's sort of leaving it up to people to kind of take that responsibility upon themselves. I would say that the Iowa legislature, which is controlled by Republicans, largely supports, certainly the Republicans support her. The Democrats feel like she acted too quickly.
And are there public health officials who have sort of publicly wrung their hands about this, or do they seem to be mostly playing along or on the same team, at least with the governor?
There was certainly some criticism when she lifted the requirement. I think fortunately cases have stayed down in the couple of weeks since that's happened. We'll see if that continues.
Okay, I want to switch now to the other big COVID story, which is the rollout of the vaccine. And Sarah Hayden, thanks again for being here. You cover politics and government for the Dispatch Argus and Quad City Times. You visited a mass vaccination site in Rock Island County in Milan, Illinois. Can you talk about how is the vaccine rollout going there? What did you see?
Actually, it's Milan. I would love that it was more similar to the wonderful city in Italy, but it is not. But yes, there is a at the Camden Center, which is the Milan Community Center, a large facility, and the Illinois National Guard is assisting with the vaccine rollout there. And I was there on Monday morning. Congresswoman Sherry Bustos, who represents the 17th Congressional District, was there to take a tour. And as you may know, Congress passed the legislation, which President Joe Biden signed into law, which allows for $20 billion in funding to go towards the vaccine rollout effort. So for distribution, for vaccinations, all the logistics that go into that. So Bustos was there as part of that kind of a victory lap, we call it. And it was fascinating. It was a parking lot was filled. People were waiting in line, but it was really well run, a very smooth process. People didn't have to wait very long, it appeared. And towards the end of the day, Rock Island County Board Health Department Administrator Nita Ludwig wanted us to announce that they had many, many openings that people were not signing up for. So now it appears to almost reversed, where they've got more vaccine than people available to vaccinate. I think it's just a matter of people assume that they can't just sign up and go get a vaccine. There are some restrictions in place. Some places want you. I know on the Iowa side, you still have to be 65 years or older, or if you're a school teacher, you can qualify. And I think it appears that Illinois' standards are a bit more broad and they can cover more general population. But yeah, I was really impressed. It seems to be off and running, and there is hope.
Listeners, if you are just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking to three reporters who cover both Illinois and Iowa for our weekly reporter roundtable. We're talking about some of the stories that are affecting both states, especially the part of the 21st listening area that's near the border between Illinois and Iowa. Michelle O'Neill is news editor at WVIK, our partner station in the Quad Cities. Sarah Hayden covers politics and government for the Dispatch Argus and Quad City Times. And Stephen Gruber-Miller covers the Iowa State House and politics for the Des Moines Register. And Michelle, can you talk a little bit more about what you're seeing in terms of vaccines and eligibility? And I don't know, are people like trying to cross the border to get better appointments, that sort of thing?
Sure. Yes, people have definitely gotten the vaccine where they can get an appointment. One thing that's interesting is there in Scott County, which is the Iowa side of the Quad Cities, it rolled out the vaccine in a much different way than Rock Island County Health Department. They distributed all their vaccine doses to providers. So hospitals, clinics, doctors, groups, community health care, and those people called their patients and those who are 65 and older. And just this month, Iowa is beginning to vaccinate people who are 64 and younger with serious conditions that make them higher risk if they get COVID-19 for serious illness. Anyway, that was a very different way of rolling it out. In Rock Island County, the very first vaccination clinic, they had people waiting in line because they did not have them sign up for appointments online. And there were cars lined up in Milan for that, vaccine rollout. And so they've, like Sarah said, dramatically improved the process where people have appointments and they don't have to line up. But anyway, there are people in the Quad Cities who go to doctors on either side of the river. So there, I know people who live in Illinois and they had a doctor in Iowa call them and say, you know, we have doses of vaccine. Do you want to come and get a dose? And this particular person had already had one through the Rock Island County Health Department, so they declined. But that sort of thing is definitely happening. And people who live in different counties in the surrounding area are also signing up to come to the Quad Cities to get vaccinated because they work here as well as, you know, socialize here, even though they might live in Henry County or Whiteside County.
Okay, Stephen Gruber-Miller, I want to switch gears now a little bit and talk about politics. Iowa recently made some changes to early voting. Can you talk a little bit about what those changes were and who's behind that effort?
Yeah, that's right. Iowans now have less time to vote early in elections. The governor, Governor Reynolds, signed a law earlier this month that shortens the early voting period from 29 days to 20. It also requires absentee ballots to be received by county auditors by the time polls close in order to be counted. Previously in Iowa, your ballot would be counted if it was placed in the mail the day before election day, as long as it arrived within the next 6 days. There are several other restrictions as well, including closing the polls an hour earlier on election day. This is driven by Republicans. The legislation only got Republican votes when it passed. Democrats say this is going to suppress votes, but Republicans say it's about ensuring sort of uniformity of elections across Iowa's 99 counties. They've said it's going to shorten the campaign season, although that's disputed. And they've also talked about sort of instilling confidence in elections, which Democrats say this doesn't really do.
Yeah, I guess who is lacking that confidence is the question. And just I'm going to go off the top of my head here, so this is a little dangerous, but comparing and contrasting to Illinois, which is, you know, in recent years expanded early voting so that there's not really an election day anymore. There's more like an election month or month and a half. And then also you can have your, as long as your ballot's postmarked by election day in Illinois, it can arrive up to 14 days after the election. You're saying that this, under this new law, if it's not in by close of the polls on election day, I mean, this goes right to the heart of what we saw was the dispute that the, you know, the false stories promulgated by the president in terms of how the votes went up as the mail-in ballots were counted in the days after the election in some states.
Right. I mean, I think Iowa's historically has had pretty much bipartisan support for it, the system of early voting that it's had, you know, over several years, but we're sort of seeing that shrink down now with Republicans having full control of state government. This needing the ballots to be in on election day is a big change. I mean, really, it reduces the timeline significantly, especially when you're shortening the early voting window on the front end as well. So it effectively cuts a week, sort of a week off of the back end, while you're cutting 9 days off the front end as well. So anyone wanting to vote by mail, you know, is going to need to have their need to be pretty quick on the jump if they want to make sure it gets counted and gets in the mail in time.
Well, this is part of a bigger national story, and I'm sure we will talk more about voting laws in the future on our show. Sarah, I want to come back to you. Another story you've been following, and we only have just a couple of minutes left at this point, but the Rock Island County's abandoned courthouse. This building goes back to the 1800s. What is going on there?
Right. So the Rock Island County Board voted, I believe, in the summer of 2018 to demolish that historic structure. It was built between 1896 and 1898. And of course, it has a long history there. Now, they complained that it was asbestos ridden, which it was, and it was decrepit. It no longer met the modern needs that they needed to maintain county operations. So they built a new courthouse next door, but by law, they could not call it a courthouse because in order to build a courthouse, you have to have a referendum with the voters. So to kind of get around that, they pulled a sneaky move, and now they call the new courthouse the Annex. And so anyways, in the meantime, they tried to push ahead with demolishing the current, the old historic county courthouse. There's a Maine preservation group, as you may have heard of, called Landmarks Illinois, and their mission is to save structures in the state and preserve them for historic preservation. Landmarks Illinois filed suit against Rock Island County to keep them from demolishing the old courthouse. And six other plaintiffs joined in, including the Moline Preservation Society, the Rock Island Preservation Society, and several individuals. So they've been somewhat successful in that. The suit was initially dismissed, and then they won on appeal to get a restraining order to keep the building from being demolished. And during that time, during the TRO time period, the county must fill out all of the meet the requirements with the State Historic Preservation Office. In other words, they have to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt, the building cannot be saved. And it's just been in legal limbo for the last 2 years. So there's been a big development in the last 2 weeks.
Okay, there's well, that's a great moment to tease. We do need to take a break on the show. We will talk about the big development. Stay tuned if you want to hear about the big development with the Rock Island County Courthouse. Coming up after a short break here on the 21st, we'll continue this conversation. Then, notable women from Illinois history to close out the show. Stay with us. You're listening to the 21st. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking about border stories today from the west coast of Illinois. How many times am I going to use that joke? The Quad Cities is what we are focusing on when we're talking with three reporters from that region. Michelle O'Neill is news editor at WVIK, our partner station in the Quad Cities. We've also been speaking with Stephen Gruber-Miller, who covers the Iowa State House and politics for the Des Moines Register, and Sarah Hayden, who is senior politics and government reporter for the Dispatch Argus and Quad City Times. And before the break, Sarah, you were talking about the abandoned Rock Island County Courthouse. You said there is a big development there. What's going on?
So that big development is that there's a local developer here named Joe Lemon, who's well known in the area. He's developed several historic properties, renovated them for reuse, and he's been successful in his endeavors. So a year ago, the federal government, the General Services Administration arm of the government, made an announcement seeking a new location for a Rock Island for a new federal district courthouse to be located in Rock Island. Now that would be the district courthouse for the Central District of Illinois. They had problems with their own building in downtown Rock Island several years ago. They had flooding problems, asbestos, black mold. So they've been using the courthouse in Scott County, the district courthouse over there. So Illinois residents have had to cross the bridge to conduct business at that federal courthouse in the meantime. So Joe Lemon submitted a bid to the GSA offering up the old Rock Island County Courthouse. The catch is that Joe Lemon does not own the building. The county refused to enter into a purchase agreement with him so that he could show that he was the owner. He was going to offer to renovate the building. This would cost millions of dollars. He could use historic tax credits to get it done, but it would still be his out-of-pocket expense. And then in turn, he would lease it to the government on a 20-year lease. Word got out. A lot of people from the public really are in support of this idea. And so the county board seems to have been to have reversed course. They are actually, they voted last night at the county board meeting to enter into negotiations with Joe Lemon for a purchase agreement. So this is very exciting. This is unprecedented. I was caught completely off guard by this vote because there are several new board members on the county board who seem to have convinced the old guard, so to speak, the ones who originally voted to demolish the building. They've convinced them to kind of change their minds to reconsider this, because nobody can really argue that that would not be the perfect location for a federal courthouse. It would provide additional protection to the courthouse, the county courthouse behind it. And so we'll see. The building is being toured today by the GSA. And from here, it's really in the government's hands. If the federal government isn't interested, well, then there's not much more that can be done. but at least this is a big step in that direction.
So many times we hear about historic preservation defeats. It's interesting to hear that this one may actually be moving forward in some way. Let's just do a couple of minutes left in our segment. Stephen, I think I'm going to end with you. I want to go back across the border now to Iowa. A big national story the last couple of weeks is one of your colleagues at the Des Moines Register, Andrea Sahuri. She was arrested covering the protests last summer after the death of George Floyd. Can you tell us what is the latest on that case?
Right. Andrea's case went to trial last week, and she was acquitted on charges of failure to disperse and interference with official acts. I think it's safe to say we're happy she was acquitted. She was there on assignment doing her job as a reporter. And
I've read she identified herself as a reporter to a police
correct.
Officer who said, that's not what correct. I asked, and sprayed her with, you know, mace or pepper spray or something anyway.
Right. Yeah. So she was there as a journalist, identified herself as such, and was still arrested, charged, and ultimately brought to trial, but acquitted because the jury found that she had not broken any laws.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's so unusual to have journalists actually prosecuted. You know, sometimes they're arrested and then the local authorities say, this was a mistake. What does the prosecutor say was their thinking behind going forward with this case?
So he has said that journalists don't deserve special treatment, which is true. We have the same First Amendment rights as everyone else. But he said that, you know, he was essentially treating this case like any other case of somebody charged at a protest. But he also implied, even though this was not the argument that his team made in the courtroom, that Andrea was a part of the protests. So I don't know what to make of that, I guess.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I guess we'll let listeners can explore that story on their own if they want to and make up their own minds about it. I want to thank my guests. They've been Stephen Gruber-Miller, who covers the Iowa State House and politics for the Des Moines Register, Sarah Hayden from the Dispatch Argus and Quad City Times, and Michelle O'Neill is the news editor at WVIK. Thank you all so much for being here with me today on the 21st. More to come in just a moment.